It's the Burt Cohen Show. Country goes on and on and on, and there's never a shortage of issues to talk about. One of the things that has happened to the U.S. in the past, 60 years or so, a little bit more than 60 years, is defending the state of Israel, seemingly always under attack. Some very strong supporters here in the United States often feel, well, Israel can do no wrong. Sometimes people feel, I've heard grumblings from people in the State Department that we seem to be working for the State of Israel, perhaps more than the interests of the United States. Well, moves at the UN by Palestinian Authority Mahmoud Abbas are stirring things up quite a bit in an area that may not really need much stirring up. Maybe it'll bring stability. Maybe it'll bring more war. We're talking about an effort to have the United Nations vote on statehood, recognition of statehood for Palestine. A lot of people are on all different sides in this issue. Not all the Palestinians are in agreement. And here with us on the Burt Cohen Show to put some good perspective on what's going on, what it all means to Israel, the Palestinians, and to the U.S., is our guest today, Robert Naiman. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Robert Naiman is Policy Director at Just Foreign Policy. Love that title. And writes on American foreign policy at the Huffington Post. Robert Naiman has worked as a policy analyst and researcher at the Center for Economic and Policy Research and Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Well, we've had a two-decade-old Oslo peace process that hasn't brought any peace and hasn't brought any new state. What has gone on with the Oslo process? What is the Oslo process supposed to be about, Robert?
From the point of view of the Palestinians, the Oslo process was supposed to lead to the establishment of an independent Palestinian state in the territories occupied by Israel in the 1967 war, the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. As you mentioned, that hasn't happened. And the fact that Oslo has not led to that is an important part of the backstory of this move of the Palestinians to the UN. There's a widespread perception among Palestinians and others that the so-called peace process, which is really a U.S. Dominated diplomatic process involving the U.S., Israel, and the Palestinians, to some extent a little bit of involvement from the Europeans, this process has failed and will continue to fail, that negotiations with the Netanyahu government will lead nowhere. The Netanyahu government has refused even to freeze the expansion of Israeli settlements in the West Bank, which Palestinians and others see as fatal to their hopes for an independent Palestinian state. And the Netanyahu government has refused to even accept the 1967 borders as a baseline for negotiations. So what the Palestinians are trying to do, I think, several things with this move. And of course, we don't know how it will shake out, but there's many possible benefits to the Palestinians in this move. First of all, it's a question of putting their grievances on the table. You know, as we've seen from the press coverage, the debate and discussion around this is returning the issue of Palestinian rights and Palestinian claims to center stage. So if they accomplish nothing else, they accomplish that. Secondly, I think there's a hope that the recognition at the United Nations, whatever form that takes, as well as, you know, the related question of bilateral recognition by states, more than 100 governments have recognized the state of Palestine, that these things will improve the position of the Palestinians in negotiations, which has been, their position has been very weak. I think everyone acknowledges that.
Nice.
And finally, there's the possibility that upgrading a Palestinian status at the United Nations will open the door to pursuing legal and political claims through the United Nations institutions. So bringing cases against the Israeli government officials at the International Criminal Court. Israel is not a party to the ICC, but countries in Europe are, and that means that Israeli officials in Europe could be held to account. The Wall Street Journal on Saturday pointed out that the Palestinians, if they were recognized as a state, might be able to join the Law of the Sea Treaty, which would give them the opportunity to challenge the Israeli blockade on Gaza. So there are avenues for redress of grievances that the Palestinians may have greater access to if they are recognized as a state by the United Nations.
Our guest today is Robert Naaman, Policy Director at Just Foreign Policy. And we're talking about a vote coming up soon at the UN. It's been very, very controversial. And some people have pointed out the reluctance of Hamas, the more militant wing of the Palestinians that was elected to power in the Gaza area. They are reluctant to support the statehood effort. So some people who are perhaps with J Street, peace side of Israeli politics, the people who are suggesting, you know, maybe there ought to be some sort of compromise. Maybe it ought to be not so one-sided, so hardcore against any recognition of Palestinians. They're saying that the fact that Hamas isn't in favor of this vote indicates there might be some potential benefits if the state of Palestine is recognized. If Israel and Palestine both have seats in the UN, perhaps that would be to Israel's advantage. What are your comments on that? What's your read on that, Robert?
Well, the story is complicated. I think, you know, from a Palestinian point of view, it's unfortunate that Hamas is criticizing this move. Obviously, Palestinians want to be united, not divided. I think the a big motivator for the criticism is the, you know, the dynamic within Palestinian politics. I think that, you know, regardless of what one thinks are the merits or the demerits of this move, there isn't any question, I think, among reasonable people that this initiative is boosting Abbas. For years, President Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas's main political liability among Palestinians has been the perception that he's a tool of the U.S. and Israel, you know, that he's playing the U.S.-Israeli game of negotiations that lead nowhere. He's helping with the security crackdown on armed resistance, and he totally opposes any act of violence as part of resistance. So,
right.
So now here we have this moment where, so because of this, he's become, you know, significantly discredited among many Palestinians. Well, of course, now, you know, the U.S. is attacking him. Israel is attacking him. The whole world is rallying around him. So, obviously, it's good for him politically. And I think that some of the negative reaction from Hamas is coming from that, is, you know, seeing it in the context of intra-Palestinian rivalry. And so J Street is pointing out some of those dynamics. This is, you know, standing up to the U.S. is good for your street cred if you're a Palestinian politician. So, and, you know, the as I said, this is a real benefit. I mean, you know, I would also say that what the Palestinian leadership is showing here, in part, is that they can tweak the nose of the great powers without anybody picking up a gun. You know, the classic, if you go back, you know, decades to when Palestinian, you know, commandos were hijacking airplanes, whatever, and you could talk to Palestinians, and he said, well, you know, what's the logic of this? You know, what's the rationale for this? We'd say, well, the world is ignoring us.
Right.
You know, we're suffering this tremendous injustice and nobody's paying attention. The world is ignoring us. And we have to do something to get the attention of the world. Well, you know, regardless of what you think about that, the morality of that argument, the fact of the matter is that the Palestinian leadership has shown that they can get the attention of the world through diplomatic initiative in politics, at least in this historical moment. You know, maybe this, what they're doing now wouldn't have been possible 20 years. But in this historical moment, the Palestinian leadership is showing that they can, you know, they can grab the lapel of the world with diplomatic and political initiatives. And, of course, this is a new moment in the politics of the region with the Arab Spring, the new government in Egypt, the increasing assertiveness of the government of Turkey. There is, you know, if they had done this initiative a year ago, the Arab countries would have supported them. But now, you know, we have these governments, the government of Turkey, the government of Egypt, that have more credibility in world opinion because they're democratic governments. And because they're clearly responding to popular aspirations in the region. So this is one of the dynamics that makes this so interesting, is that it's happening in the context of the Arab Spring. Press coverage, some of it is pointing this out. You know, here's the U.S. government wants to be perceived in the region as being on the side of the people in Egypt, in Libya,
in Yemen,
in Syria. But what about Palestine? No Arab Spring for Palestine? So this is why, part of why the U.S. has been so eager to try and head this off. Because if the U.S. vetoes this, it's going to be a huge black eye for the United States in the Arab world.
Well, I do want to get to what's at stake here for the U.S. And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been running in sixth gear on this, you know, trying to make it not happen. And it that we're talking about, if you just tuned in to the Bert Cohen Show, is the vote coming up soon in the United Nations on a declaration of and recognition that there is, in fact, a Palestinian state and that Palestine deserves a literal seat at the table in the United Nations. Now, the move for this has the support of most nations in the General Assembly. 126 countries backed the initiative. A poll of people in England, France, and Germany showed that a majority of the population in those countries supports the initiative. By all accounts, Palestine has the votes to win. But I wonder, back to domestic politics within the divided areas of the Palestinian Authority, which is not yet a Palestinian state, it does seem that some people are concerned that the United Nations move could perhaps weaken the PLO's status as the representative of the Palestinian people as a whole. The refugees' right of return, which is very important to a lot of the older Palestinians, and suspicions among some Palestinians that this is Mahmoud Abbas pushing this thing. This is his U.S., his move, and it may be less about reinvigorating the national cause than asserting and retaining his political control. What happens if it does pass, as it's expected to, within the very divided Palestinian community?
Well, my read on opinion in the occupied territories is that, and, you know, also looking at poll data, is that people overwhelmingly support this move. There is criticism from within and also from without, and some of the exile communities don't necessarily see things the same way as Palestinians living under occupation see it. But the overall thrust is that people support this move. Now, of course, you know, there are caveats. People have, after, you know, their experience of so many years of seeing Abbas and the Palestinian leadership play the U.S. game, you know the saying of once burned, twice caution.
Yeah.
So I think even people that are supportive are suspicious of the willingness of the Palestinian leadership to follow through with the policy of diplomatic confrontation.
Mm.
Because for so long, the Palestinian leadership, you know, deferred to the U.S. And, of course, there are also real threats that people are concerned about. There is a threat, not just that the U.S. will veto,
right,
but you know, Congress has threatened to cut off aid, and some Israeli officials have threatened to annex parts of the West Bank.
Whoa.
And impose more restrictions and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of question marks about consequences that, you know, are making people anxious. But I think overall the majority supports the move. Now, the issue of refugees, well, there's some debate about that. Some people have claimed that there's something about this move that could compromise the right of return. I haven't seen anything really convincing documenting that that's the case, that there's anything intrinsic about that. There is sort of a second argument, which is that, you know, not all Palestinians support the two-state solution.
True.
Even grudgingly.
Yep.
Many Palestinians support it grudgingly, but some Palestinians refuse to support it at all. And I think for Palestinians who totally oppose it, you know, they're the ones that are most likely to oppose this move, because this move is clearly in the context, happening in the context of advocacy for the two-state solution, which has been the position of the Palestinian leadership since 1974. So what they're doing, so I think you have to distinguish between those two things. You know, this, if you're against a two-state solution, then you're going to be against this, but then you were against the Palestinian policy, you know, going back to 1974. This move is entirely consistent with the longstanding thrust of Palestinian diplomacy and Arab diplomacy, which is two-state solution, independent Palestinian state in the territories occupied by Israel in 1967.
We are talking with Robert Naaman of Just Foreign Policy about the upcoming vote at the United Nations on Palestinian statehood. Some have suggested that the vote could be kind of an empty gesture to gain in popular support, Abbas, of course. But even if this passes, as it probably will, the Palestinian lives will be changed very little at all. And I can't help but think that there'd be some concern that you have. Okay, I mean, this would be a very general concern of a two-state solution, that you have a powerful Jewish state and kind of a small state that is fragmented and useless next to this big state of Israel. So that perhaps, I wonder, but you've probably heard more than I have, Robert, about whether or not there's within the Palestinian community, a move away from the traditional approach of a two-state solution, because I can see how this would, and perhaps having just a mixed secular state of Israel-Palestine, and maybe there's very little support for that, but and it's also wondering about the Palestinian Authority's readiness to govern. They are, you know, notoriously corrupt and dysfunctional. So what about how lives would really be changed after this vote, if at all?
Okay, well, there's, you touched on several different things here, so let me try and separate the issues. One question is, you know, how much would achieving a state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, what's that worth? What would that accomplish? And who supports that? So overwhelmingly, this path is certainly supported by the overwhelming majority of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. I mean, this is the platform of Fatah. It's also the platform of Hamas. It's the platform of all the major Palestinian factions, the platform of the PLO.
What is the two-state solution?
Two-state solution, uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, Hamas has a slightly different take on it, or maybe not slightly, depending, you know, on your view of these things. But Hamas also supports the two-state solution, their own formulation of it. So this is the dominant thrust of Palestinian politics, two-state solution. Now, what would it accomplish? Well, I can tell you that I've lived in the West Bank. I lived in Ramallah. I lived in Bir Zeit, near Ramallah. I lived in Hebron. And for people in the West Bank, it would be a very big deal to get Israeli troops and Israeli settlers out of their towns and off their land.
Would that...
You just can't have any idea if you've never, you know, seen it or, you know, read about it or sort of looked at it directly, what the occupation means for daily life for people in the West Bank. It means that their travel is heavily restricted, just going from one town to another. It means that farmers are prevented from farming their lands. It means that your young people are arbitrarily arrested. It means constant presence and harassment of Israeli soldiers and settlers. So it's a very two-state solution means getting Israeli soldiers and settlers out of the West Bank, which it does. I mean, that's two-state solution is, from the point of view of Palestinians, then it's a very huge deal. Yes, of course, you know, there are some voices that say, no, we don't want that. You know, we want a one-state solution, we want a democratic secular state, and everybody has their same rights, and so on and so forth. And of course, those people are entitled to their views, but it's important to recognize that this is not the main thrust of Palestinian politics. The people with these views haven't won any election to represent Palestinians, and Palestinian point. Diplomacy has to be based on what the majority is pushing. And one of the arguments that's made on behalf of this sort of one-state solution idea seems to me not to make any sense. The argument is made, it's commonly made, well, the two-state solution has failed. It's never going to happen. And so we should have the one-state solution. But, you know, it's very important to distinguish between a one state, having one state, and having one state where everyone has equal rights. To get to having one state, in a sense, that's the situation today. Today there is one state,
true.
State of Israel, yep. which is pretty much controlling everything between the Mediterranean and the River Jordan. What's different, what's not present, is equal rights.
Right.
And we're very far away from that.
Yeah.
And the you know, the question of the two-state solution in Israeli politics is kind of a jump ball. You have, you know, not a majority right now for a real settlement, perhaps, but it's not totally implausible. There's no constituency, almost no constituency in Israeli public opinion for a one-state solution now where everyone has equal rights. It's very far away. And, you know, what happens to the Israeli settlers in the West Bank under a one-state solution? Do they stay? In which case, you know, if you think about what the settlers aren't, just, you know, don't just happen to be there. They are part and parcel of the occupation. Having the settlers there means having the Israeli army there. It means disproportionate use of water and other resources. So to me, the one-state solution today, if by that you mean equal rights,
right.
that from where we are right now, that's pie in the sky.
Well.
So, you know, people should feel free to obviously to advocate whatever they want to advocate for, but not to use it as a reason, you know, advocate for what you want, but don't use it as a reason to oppose or undermine something practical that people are trying to achieve that would bring about a lot of justice, a lot more justice for a lot of people.
So we took
right now, and one can hope, and I think this is plausible, that if there were a two-state solution, and the one-state solution isn't going to be achieved by coercion. No army is going to come in and create this, you know, wonderful democratic secular state.
That's for sure.
If the two-state solution happens now, and the environment of confrontation is ended, I think that's more likely to create an evolution towards civil rights, greater civil rights for Palestinians inside the Green Line, inside pre-1967 Israel. And I'm not the only person that thinks that. Palestinian citizens of Israel, the overwhelming majority, have long held that, and that's why they've supported the two-state solution, even though it doesn't directly do anything for them. It was based on, well, first of all, you know, solidarity and justice, but also that would benefit them by ending the confrontation. If you imagine today that the U.S. were occupying Mexico and that there were an insurgency in Mexico that U.S. soldiers were fighting, and you think about how that might impact Mexican-Americans, it probably wouldn't be good. It probably wouldn't be good for the status of Mexican-Americans in the United States to have the U.S. fighting a counterinsurgency war in Mexico. You know, think about how World War II was for Japanese Americans,
right,
or how, you know, the global war on terror has been for Muslims. Arabs and Muslims in
sure.
the U.S. today.
Right.
So if you were a Mexican American and the U.S. were counting were fighting a counterinsurgency war in Mexico, you'd want that war to end. You would want the U.S. troops to withdraw from Mexico, not only because of your concern about what's happening to Mexicans, but because you figure that ending the war is going to make my life more normal. And I think the same is true for the Palestinian citizens of Israel.
And we talk about making a difference in people's lives. It sounds like you're saying, Robert Nayman, that when a state is declared by the United Nations, then the Israeli soldiers and settlers at that point would have to leave, that they could no longer be in the occupied area because it would be, in fact, Palestine? Would that be the case right then and there, immediately?
No, thank you for asking that. That was another part of your question I didn't address. So you asked, you know, is the two-state solution useful, and then is this what's happening in New York useful? And obviously those are two different things. The hope is that what's happening in New York will help produce the two-state solution. But obviously, in and of itself, it's not going to do that immediately. And the next day after the vote, Palestinians are going to wake up in Hebron, and they're still going to have Israeli settlers in the middle of their city. But the terrain on which the conflict will take place will be different. And this, I think, it's also a question of how aggressively Palestinian leadership and others pursue the opportunities that will be created by this. There will still be a political decision that they'll have to take to try to join the Law of the Sea Treaty and use that treaty to press against the blockade of Gaza. There will still be a political decision they have to take to try and bring cases in the International Criminal Court. But it's already the case, you know, there was a World Court decision on the separation barrier saying that the route of the separation barrier that Israel is creating in the West Bank, that the route is illegal.
Right.
That decision has not been implemented.
Uh-huh.
But it shows that there's an opening to for Palestinians to pursue through the international institutions like the International Criminal Court. We saw with the Goldstone report Israeli invasion of Gaza that although it didn't necessarily directly lead to holding any Israeli officials to account, I think it contributed a great deal to making the Israeli government pay a price politically for the for the invasion of Gaza.
Right.
So Will it immediately change anything on the ground? No, but I think that's the wrong standard to measure it by. It's certainly not one standard that we would measure other things by. People are, struggling for justice and freedom. They don't measure every interim measure by that standard. You do things to improve your position for struggles in the future. You hold a demonstration. You hold a demonstration against the war. After the demonstration, the war is still taking place. Does that mean the demonstration was useless?
Right.
No. So that's we wouldn't use that way of thinking in any other arena. You know, if you took that argument to its logical extreme, you'd never go to a demonstration. You'd never write a letter to the editor. You'd never vote. You'd never attend any political event. Right.
There are
steps. We do lots of things.
Sure, there are
that
steps.
Don't immediately bring about the result that we want. We're building toward the result that we want, and there's a wide body of opinion that if the Palestinians get this recognition, it's going to improve their position in many ways, improve their position in negotiations, improve their position in pressing their case through the international institutions, and improve their position. You know, we've seen all these threats against the Palestinians for pursuing this course. If they pursue this course and they live to tell the tale, they'll prove to themselves, to the Palestinian people and to the world, that they're capable of independent action and that they can't be bullied to death by the United States. That in itself will be a tremendous victory, which will boost future efforts for Palestinian freedom.
One question, and we're talking with Robert Naiman, Policy Director at Just Foreign Policy. I'm Bert Cohen. Is in this newly declared Palestine, I wonder what would happen to any Jewish people there. Would it be a Palestinian state free of Jews? And then conversely, in the state of Israel right now, there's 1.3 million Muslims who are Israeli citizens. Would they be forced to move? I think about the scene in the movie Gandhi, where the Hindus are going one way, the Muslims are going the other, and it's some tough stuff. What do you think, how might that be addressed once the state is declared?
First of all, it's important to recognize that the situation is asymmetric, and the Palestinians have never been talking about doing a population exchange. The premise of the two-state solution has always been that Palestinian citizens of Israel can remain in Israel. In fact, the Palestinians would like to see at least some amount of return allowed by the Israeli government and Palestinians to return to
their old lands
to Israel, but that the Israeli settlers have to go. And you might say, if you just think of that as you know, Jews and Arabs or Jews and Muslims, you would think that that's asymmetric, right? That's unfair. How come Jews have to leave the new Palestinian state, but Arabs don't have to leave Israel? And the answer is, yes, it's asymmetric along this one dimension, if you just focus on that one dimension. But on the other hand, the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem represent 22% of mandatory Palestine. And so from the Palestinian point of view, there are other aspects of this that are highly asymmetric on the other side. You know, the Israel is retaining 78% of mandatory Palestine, and the Palestinians are only getting 22%. And it's also not necessarily the 22% that you would pick if you were starting from scratch.
Indeed.
You know, if you go back to before 1948, and, you know, what Palestinians thought of as Palestine, it wasn't Ramallah. You know, Ramallah was a backwater.
Mm-hmm.
Jaffa was the New York City of Palestine.
Mm.
And that's what even many older Palestinians think of as Palestine, is Jaffa. Well, that's not, Palestinians aren't getting Jaffa back and as part of the two-state solution. Everything that people say about limitations of the two-state solution from the point of view of Palestinians, It's true, you know, the majority of population of Gaza, for example, are refugees from 1948. So, and it's one of the densest, more most as a result of that huge refugee population, more densely populated places on Earth. So Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem is going to have a lot of issues to deal with. And the last thing they need to deal with is the Israeli settlers who, you know, again, are not mere guests, but have been implanted throughout the West Bank in a way that compromises the well-being of the local population. The confiscate land that belongs to the local population, the security for the Israeli settlers greatly harms the local population. They have to use separate roads than the Israeli roads. They're subject to all kinds of security restrictions as a result of the Israeli government protections of settlers. Settlers use a disproportionate amount of resources like water. So, you know, you're in Hebron in the summer and you turn on the faucet and there's no water, and you go to the Israeli settlement of Kiryat Arba near Hebron and they have plenty of water.
Right.
So, so all these things, so for Palestinians, the Palestinians support the two-state solution. They don't see the settlers as Jewish guests. They see them as Israeli colonists that have been implanted by the occupation. It is a deliberate strategy to prevent Palestinians from being free in their land. And, you know, again, hopefully, and it's really an unfortunate thing about the conflict that the two things have become conflated. And again, I think hopefully in the long run, there's a political settlement and Palestinians are allowed to be free in the 1967 territories. Over time, these issues will go away and, you know, more normal relations will ensue between Israelis and Palestinians, and it will be, again, be a not a big deal to see, you know, Israeli tourists in Ramallah. That would just be kind of a normal thing. But right now, unfortunately, you know, it's entangled with the occupation. And I would say that in my experience, you know, again, I live there. The majority of people there are not anti-Jewish, and you see now, you know, regularly there are joint demonstrations and Israeli peace activists come to places like Budrus and Bilin and Silwan and demonstrate in solidarity with the local Palestinians against the occupation. But so for Palestinians, you know, Jews are one thing and settlers are another.
Ah, good point. I'm glad that distinction is there because certainly not all Jews are Zionists for that matter. And there's people want to get along. A lot of people within the current state of Israel would very much like to have some compromise and have some peace. Now, I want to turn, Robert Nayman, to the effects on the United States. It's in a very, very difficult position. Now, President Obama is somehow perceived as the most anti-Israel president since Jimmy Carter. Yet he's always had Netanyahu's back and never really criticized them. And we hear from Saudi Prince Turki Al-Faisal. I hope I pronounced that right. And he's talking about the widespread perception in the Arab world of America as Israel's staunchest defender. He, this former U.S. Saudi U.S. ambassador has said that if Washington vetoes a Palestinian state, as is expected, it will lose Saudi Arabia, which is its closest Arab ally. A quote from him, he says, this is Saudi Prince Turki Al-Faisal, the United States must support the Palestinian bid for statehood at the UN this month or risk losing the little credibility it has in the Arab world. He goes on to say, if it does not support statehood, American influence will decline further, Israeli security will be undermined, and Iran will be empowered, increasing the chances of another war in the region. Couldn't there be another, like, obvious solution? Couldn't the U.S. introduce a resolution into the United Nations supporting both Palestine's and Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state, with the U.S. then emerging as a hero rather than a villain? Any possibility of this happening? What's going to happen to the U.S. If it does veto it? What's going to happen to our role there, and, you know, any dangers to the U.S.?
Well, the U.S., the Obama administration, I'm afraid, is caught between a rock and a hard place, politically, because what the Saudi ambassador described is certainly what people in the region expect. It's going to be a huge blow to the credibility of the United States in the region if it vetoes this resolution. You know, the U.S. has vetoed resolutions opposed by Israel before, but, and of course, you know, that was something that it paid a price for before. But now this is happening at a different level in terms of public attention and scrutiny that's happening in the context of the Arab Spring. So there is a big price to be paid for a U.S. veto, and I think this is why the U.S. has been, working the phone to try and make something else happen. It's not clear that there is any path that involves an alternative resolution, and there isn't any evidence that the U.S. is pursuing that. The obstacle on the Israeli side is the issue here is not the issue of returning to negotiations is not something that can really be papered over with rhetoric, because there are these two questions of freezing the expansion of Israeli settlements and negotiating on the basis of the 1967 borders, which so far the Israeli government has refused to do. Right. I think at least any time up until maybe a week ago, if the U.S. government could have succeeded in moving the Israeli government on these two points, they might have been able to get a diplomatic solution. Mm. It's not clear whether that's, you know, after a certain point, the Palestinians are committed politically. But who knows? They're certainly trying. But I think the main obstacle is that they can't get the Israeli government to move. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, on the other hand, you have the domestic political considerations in the United States.
Yeah.
The presidential campaign is underway. The one thing that most of the Republican candidates agree on is certainly the, you know, so-called top-tier or front-runner candidates, is that, as he said, you know, President Obama hasn't been good enough to Israel. They're criticizing about policy towards Iran. And, you know, I'm sure the president's political advisors are going to advocate that he veto in light of the domestic political and electoral considerations. We just saw this special election in New York, where the Democratic candidate was defeated in a district that historically perceived as being Democratic, but which has happened to have a large population of Orthodox Jews, and the former Democratic mayor of New York, former Democratic as well as being former mayor, Ed Koch, endorsed the Republican candidate,
saying that
you know, we need to send President Obama a message about Israel.
Wow.
So there's no question that, you know, the White House political people are thinking about these dynamics, and that creates the rock and the hard place.
Yes.
So in terms of consequences for U.S. policy in the region, you know, the U.S. needs to move. In terms of the current, electoral dynamics in the U.S., they'll pay a price for moving, and this is why they push for a diplomatic resolution. But it's not clear that at this stage a diplomatic resolution is possible, so long as the Israeli government retains its current political complexion, not only headed by Netanyahu, but this very right wing coalition that's against any concessions to the Palestinians whatsoever.
Man, it sure is a mess. Couldn't get much messier. We're talking with Robert Nayman, Policy Director at Just Foreign Policy. I'm Bert Cohen. And you talk about the rock and the hard place, both very, very hard and solid surfaces. As you say, on one hand, you have the Republicans ready to pounce on any flexibility Obama were to show in any kind of perceived weakness toward Israel, because they're, you're right, absolutely united in their support. Israel can do no wrong, whatever Israel wants, you know, just totally go with that. And yet, on the other hand, the real politic of the world, and an old professor of mine said, politics is the economy of violence. If the U.S. vetoes it, if the political arguments that Obama has to support a veto on this, then in the world, in the court of world opinion, isn't there a possible further marginalization of the United States? We could lose Saudi Arabia, my goodness, who have always been there, and like they have some oil that we might need a little bit thereof. Is the United States guaranteed to be the real loser in this? And Robert, couldn't the veto trigger a wave of protests across the United States, but more importantly, perhaps in the world, and even encourage more attacks by marginalizing the United States?
Well, I hope it doesn't encourage more attacks. I do hope that it encourages protests. I see those as two very different things.
Good point.
I hope that it does galvanize opinion against the United States. I hope that protest is expressed nonviolently. The Palestinian leadership has called for demonstrations this week in support of the UN bid,
right.
And I do think that the U.S. veto will galvanize opinion.
I'm sure.
Not only in the occupied territories, but also in Egypt and Turkey and elsewhere.
In Western Europe.
This issue isn't going to go away.
Right.
As long as the dispossession of the Palestinians is not addressed, this is going to be a cost to the U.S. And the cost is increasing. It's increasing dramatically. You know, there's just been a big shift in the region. There was a status quo. If you look at Egypt, for example, you know, there was an equilibrium in Israeli-Egyptian relations that dates back to 1979 and the Camp David Treaty. And that equilibrium has come undone. Now, I don't think necessarily that the peace treaty is going to be revoked. I think it probably won't. But beyond the document of the treaty, there was a question of how it was sort of politically interpreted by the Mubarak government. The way that the treaty was interpreted by the Mubarak government was to say to the U.S., okay, you know, we're going to be pro-Israel, and you're going to give us, you know, $1.3 billion in military aid, and that's the basis of our relationship. And the protests and uprising in Egypt undermined that, obviously.
Yeah.
And it got rid of Mubarak, but it also didn't just get rid of Mubarak, it undid the bargain. The reason that the U.S. couldn't make any progress lobbying the Egyptian government on human rights and democracy is that the Egyptian government at the end of the day said, look, we know what you want. We know what you really want. You really want us to help you with Israel. And that's what you get out of our bargain, to shut up about human rights and democracy because we don't want to hear it.
Mm.
Well, that bargain obviously has become undone, and the new Egyptian government, the interim government that's been produced by the uprising, although it's still not a democratically elected government, it is more accountable to Egyptian public opinion.
Yeah.
And this is one way that's easy for them to move. So, for example, they have somewhat eased the closure of the Egypt-Gaza crossing, the Rafah crossing.
Mm-hmm.
They helped broker this reconciliation agreement between Fatah and Hamas. They're meeting with Turkey. They're talking about joint efforts with Turkey on behalf of the Palestinians. Obviously, the Egyptians are leaders in the push at the United Nations. So the world has changed. The region has changed.
Yeah.
And U.S. policy is going to have to change as a result of that change. And the Israeli government, the president of the Israeli government, is a product of the previous environment. The previous environment, which it wasn't really necessary in the perception of many Israelis. It wasn't necessary to compromise because the status quo is livable, and we're nobody can really interfere with us. Well, you know, that situation is undergoing a process of transformation. Huge. And the United States government, the Israeli government, are going to have to adjust to it.
It's been interesting how what members of Congress are doing here, and, you know, holding to their regular position of standing firm for Israel and against any effort by the Palestinians to assert statehood. There's been a suggestion that, in fact, they're dangling the threat of no aid because the U.S. has given some aid to the Palestinian Authority. They're saying, well, we're not going to give you aid if you go forward with this. But luckily, Representatives David Price of North Carolina and Peter Welch of Vermont have circulated a letter to the president which says that the suspension or ending of U.S. aid could undermine the very foundations of a future Palestinian state undergoing the progress, or undoing rather, the progress that's been made in recent years towards strengthening the Palestinian Authority's security and governing institutions. I don't know where this is going down in Washington, the idea of cutting off the aid there. I can't believe that would go through, but it might. And I just got to ask, as we approach the end of our time here, isn't it possible that, in fact, recognizing Palestinian statehood could really bring about some degree of peace, some mutual recognition that, you know, Palestine being at the UN, Israel being at the UN, maybe they'd say, hey, guess what? We're both here. We both have a right to exist. Might that not be something that the U.S. might really welcome, and then Israel might really welcome?
There were voices in Israel, which, and I mean, you know, like newspaper editors type voices that said, why doesn't Israel vote yes?
That would throw them.
Why didn't we vote yes? I think, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens after this. There's been, you know, obviously a lot of banging of the table, but the next day, you know, the UN is going to make some move, and then people will say what are we going to do. And I agree with you that I think that that precisely for the reasons mentioned in Peter Welch's letter, you know, the cutting off aid to the Palestinians would be very self-defeating policy for the United States, and I'm sure that the State Department will argue that. After all, there was a Palestinian national movement before there was aid from the United States, and the Palestinian national movement that existed before was more radical and more opposed to U.S. policy. And if the U.S. cuts off aid to the Palestinians, then, of course, you know, that's going to remove a big barrier to Fatah-Hamas reconciliation. So the U.S. actually isn't going to like the consequences of that. But I think you're right, that it's often the case with these kinds of developments that people pound the table and act like something is the end of the world, and then the thing happens the next day, and then they move on. So I think that something like that will be true here. I think the Palestinians have said all the way along that we don't see this as an alternative to negotiations. We're ready for negotiations. We understand that at the end of the day, the way that we're going to get a Palestinian state is a negotiated solution. We see this as a step to negotiations. So the day after this happens, Palestinians are going to say, we're ready for negotiations. So what are the Israelis going to say? No, now we're not going to talk to you because you went to the UN. So I think that, and can the U.S. say that? I don't think so. I don't think that's going to wash. So hopefully this will lead to a return to negotiations. And in addition, I hope it will lead to keeping the United Nations as a stage on which these issues are addressed, particularly through the international institutions, the International Criminal Court, the treaties, the law of the sea treaty. I think this improves the prospects for a solution, and it improves the prospects for addressing these issues peacefully, you know, through politics through diplomacy, through legality, rather than through violence.
It'll be interesting to see once this passes, as it almost surely will, although the U.S. can veto it within the Security Council. I'm hoping Obama's political people can somehow spin it in a way that he doesn't look weak, like Obama and Secretary of State Clinton lost a big one here, because it can be a first step toward peace and greater security for Israel, I would think. And if you're with Just Foreign Policy, tell us very briefly what that is and how people can read more about what Just Foreign Policy is all about.
JustForeignPolicy.org is our website. We are an organization that works to reform U.S. foreign policy so that it reflects the values and interests of the majority of Americans.
What a concept. Thank you very much. Very, very informative. Robert Nayman, Policy Director for Just Foreign Policy, thanks for being with us on The Bert Cohen Show.
Good to be with you.
Thank you, and love to hear from you, Bert, at BertCohen.com. And let's hope there's a little bit of peace that comes from all of this. Been living with war long enough.